Excision number 12503, reel 4.
Commander Lang, reel 4.
Yes, I left in July to return home. Took passage in the Marsdale, which was a freighter converted into an ocean boarding vessel whose purpose was to intercept merchant ships, neutral merchant ships, and send them into port for examination if they were carrying any form of contraband cargo. And from soon after some leave, I joined Naval Air Station Arbroath to undergo a course in airborne radar. This is a very early form of airborne versus surface ship radar.
How effective was it?
I thought it was extremely effective. It required a certain technique to get used to it, and a bit of imagination in interpreting the blips. But with practice, you could hold a blip right up to a few yards almost in certain sea conditions.
I think your next operational squadron, though, was 835.
835 was an anti-submarine squadron which had been formed over the New World, whether it was in the West Indies or the States, I don't know, and had come home as a small unit of four aircraft aboard the Furious, and had landed at Leon Solent, where I took her over from my previous commanding officer in 810, as Lieutenant Commander Johnson, and we there increased to six aircraft, and having got our complement up to date, we took off for the Orkneys, that's Haston, for a workup, and at some stage, I can't quite remember when, we increased to nine aircraft, and spent a very happy summer in the Orkneys doing all the usual weapon training, navigation training, and getting used to our aircraft, and then were moved to the Midlands.
We should say that was a summer of 42.
A summer of 42, yes, there. Moved down to the Midlands to start the sort of deck landing aspect. And we were assigned to a carrier called the Activity, which was a modified British merchant ship. Unfortunately, about this time, I think they started planning the landings in North Africa, and there was a call on carrier decks to provide fighter protection for these landings, which took priority over anti-submarine operations. As you know, as full-time anti-submarine operations, I suppose one can put it. And we were left hanging about for quite a long time with no real task to do other than sort of maintain our efficiency, whilst we were moved from airfield to airfield to airfield, getting a little bit bored. We did, however, embark in the summer of 42. In the Battler, after some deck landing training, for a convoy to Gib. And although we didn't find any submarines, there were plenty of alarms, and the fighter squadron that was embarked with us shot down a Focke-Wulf Condor on the way home, which was a nice thing to see. And then we again started our travels between airfields. And this is really quite a problem because moving the squadron, in those days you had a thing called the squadron mobile equipment, which was all your sort of toolboxes and that. and meant moving all this and about several, almost 100 men, if not more, across wartime transport, railways, buses, ferries, etc. And it always amazes me that we didn't lose anything, valuable stores. It says a lot for the people responsible, the junior officers and ratings concerned. And which is while we were at Ayr that I was given the appointment of Staff Officer Ayr, or Fleet Aviation Officer, as it was rather pompously called, to the Commander-in-Chief, Eastern Fleet.
How did you react to that appointment?
Well, it was my first staff appointment that I'd ever done. I think I was about 26 years of age. I was a bit apprehensive. However, one just had to get on with it. No one could have had a more delightful admiral than James Somerville, who was a great character. And, of course, had been our admiral in Force H when I was in Ark Royal, so I knew him quite well. And I learned the task of staff officer at the feet of the Staff Officer Plans, who was then a commander called Eden, who later became an admiral, and really taught me the tricks of the trade long before I ever did a staff course or anything like that.
It looks from your logbook that it was autumn 43 that you got this staff appointment.
Yes.
And so then there was a question of getting out to the Far East.
That was the most interesting trip. I was flown out from Poole in a converted Sunderland operated by British Overseas Airways, and because there was going to be an air raid exercise in Lisbon, which was then neutral, we had to fly or spend a night in the Shannon in Ireland. We were instructed to wear plain clothes to start with, and when we landed at the Shannon, we had to go through immigration control, and there was a member of the Gardaí who said, what are you going out to the Far East for? And something just tickled my back of my brain and said, if I say I'm going out for a naval appointment, I may well be arrested as a you know, as a combatant. So I said, first thing that came into my head was a salvage engineer, and that rather foxed him. He said, yes, salvage engineer. So I landed as a salvage engineer, and we were put up for the night in a most delightful little Irish pub, and took off next morning for the for Lisbon, where again we spent a night in a hotel and sat at tables in the restaurant with Germans next door to us.
Any signs of hard or ill feeling?
I don't know. I don't think they probably realized we were Germans. When we got back to the landing stage next morning, or whenever it was, all our baggage was on the jetty, like that, including a lot of handbags belonging to an army officer who was in an intelligence corps. And he absolutely almost screamed. He said, they shouldn't be ashore. They were all his sort of intelligence papers. They were probably more not so important as he thought they were.
Were there any hitches on your way to Ceylon?
Well, this first leg was down to Lagos. And we spent one, after leaving Lisbon, we stopped a night in Bathurst. I don't know what it's called now. It was then the British West, British Gambia. And I remember landed in the estuary there, whatever river it was. And they said, well, if you want to swim, there's the sea, but don't go in too far because there are a lot of barracuda. Of course, we hadn't got clothes or swimming pants or anything like that. We all jumped in. And we'd been told, all right, don't bother about bathing nude, because no females had been seen here for years. So we were all sort of splashing about, not too deep, you see, because of the barracuda. And along the beach, there were two ladies came towards us. What should we do?
So you caught between the barracuda
and the ladies. Yes, in those days, of course, people were more shy of these the things. Nowadays, you just turn seaward and leave it. But, it was all really rather fun, because it's very primitive. Rattan huts. You stay quite comfortable, very reasonable food. And the aircraft literally refueled by tins, you know, like you see in those old pictures of S. Alan Cobham flying out to Australia, being poured in, fuels being emptied into the top of the fuel tanks there. One thing about that Sunderland was it was there were very, very few seats as such. And I slept actually on the floor. I remember the captain of the aircraft, who was called Rose. I think he became a very distinguished, well-known British Overseas Airways pilot by the time he retired. You know, you saw him on the, heard him on the radio and saw him on British movie tone news, sort of clambering over me as he did his tour of inspection. And they had an officer on board who was actually a navigator, you know, as opposed to just a chap of the second pilot or the flight engineer who pressed the right buttons. We know with the sextant and everything. And we landed at Lagos, and then we had to change aircraft and waited for a Sabena to take us across Central Africa to Uganda and then up the Nile Valley to Cairo. That was an experience as we landed at these jungle airstrips and various towns, which were then, of course, run by or owned by the Belgians. And after landing, we went for a walk along a path, and every time these the natives saw us approach, they get right off the road. You know, real old colonial rule. What really, although I'd been brought up in India or spent my early childhood in India, I really felt quite embarrassed at this. And we were very well entertained wherever there was a European community, you know, taken out to dinner and plied with booze. It was an interesting trip. We landed, I think it was one of the East African states, I think it was Uganda, and Entebbe, that's right, and then flew up the Nile, which is interesting, landed in Khartoum, and then Cairo. Where we changed to an old C-class British Overseas Airways to fly to Karachi. Spent about two or three nights in Heliopolis. And from took off in this C-class, which was much more comfortable. It was almost the same as the Sunderland, almost identical, but there were decent seats. You know, not a hard-ass thing there. Landed in the Dead Sea. I mean, it's like landing on a brick road, on a hard road in the salt water there. Had a bathe in the Red Sea. And then on to the Basra and Sharjah, and then across the Arabian Sea to Karachi, where I disembarked and was looked after by the Indian Navy. Spent several nights there. I think the CNC Eastern Fleet was beginning to ask when I was coming, because obviously I was getting priority as God's onward passage, because there was not a people there. I'd been waiting for weeks for a passage south. And so I soon went off to the Tata Airways, single-engine aeroplane, two others, and an Indian pilot. And we flew to Bombay, where we had 24 hours. I was very ably looked after in the Taj Mahal Hotel by a chap who'd been in my term at Dartmouth. Took me round the place and great fun, and flew off south, stop at Bangalore for a night, and then on to Ceylon, where I went in head first into being a staff officer in a high-pressure unit.
What kind of work were you expected to do?
Well, what I was really, the assistant to Staff Officer Plans, this Commander Eden, and anything involving the Fleet Arm, because the carriers were coming out, I was asked to help him writing up his orders. And all the communication signals and things coming in with an air aspect, I was asked to help with. There was an Air Force liaison officer, but I seem to get still quite a lot of questions came to me. And then gradually, it as the carrier started coming out the way, I got more and more work to do. And it was really very, very interesting. And as I say, I got on extremely well with the high-placed help. And, of course, you were a war room watchkeeper, one night on in seven, I think, which meant you sat in the war room with the whole map of the Indian Ocean there, and you had to see that action was taken on any incident. It was all pretty quiet just then. You know, if people were told if any incidents happened.
How close did you come to Somerville?
But the chief of staff, almost every day, he'd sit up there in his office with a big desk, and he'd go through the signals. And, you know, he'd say, what is all this about? What's this happening? Also, you know, because the senior officer, Indian Ocean Airfields, was responsible for CNC, and if he had any question, he'd ask you. And also the operations officer would say, what's happening to this or that? And you had to know the answers. You had to know your signals. I shared an office with the staff officer submarines who got all the through-going submarine personnel coming to see him, including that famous VC, what's his name, Myers, was it?
Yes,
sir.
Yes.
Who was a tremendous character, as we were accommodated in a block of flats. And, you know, and if you were in an upper flat, there was a big stair to get to your office there. And old Myers, he could never stop talking. So he'd talk and talk and talk to this delightful colleague of mine. And then, right, finish off, and he'd get to the bottom of the stairs and he'd think of something more to say. Then he'd come rushing upstairs again. And you saw a lot of your Fleet Air Arm friends would go through, and sort of captains of carriers would come through, of small carriers. The big carriers were always far too highly placed, but the small ones would come in and try and lobby you, you know, if they had any particular point to make, or will you please see I get this, or I don't do that, or something.
How did you respond?
Well, I said, yes, sir, of course, sir.
Did you?
Sometimes, yes. I'd see, you'd go and see the chief of staff and say, so the reason behind this is such and such.
Was Myers a combative sort of chap?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I mean, you don't get a VC for nothing. There's been a lot of controversy about him.
Yes.
Probably read, yes.
So how did your work then develop?
Well, as I say, the Eastern Fleet built up, of course, got more and more sort of work across the desk. And one would be sent off on several expeditions. I had to fly to Cochin once to find out whether it's possible to land mosquitoes or get them ashore from an aircraft carrier to carry the that they dropped a rolling bomb for going to attack the Japanese fleet. You see, all sorts of plans were in the pipeline at that time. Everything was held up in the East because until the Normandy landings had been fixed, all the landing craft and everything like that. And Mountbatten was in, arrived out in Delhi with a tremendous flourish, and I gather his staff meetings were quite a show, you know, with music and the screens being pulled aside as a day's briefing. We had our own staff meetings every morning, which were full of interest. The Admiral sat there in the chair, and the staff officer intelligence would tell you what was going on, and then various people would say anything they were particularly concerned with, and then you popped off back to your office. And while Somerville was there, we never had a day off. But when Bruce Fraser came out, he insisted that every staff officer had 24 hours off, unless it was impossible. You know, he simply had to, was involved in active operations.
How did you like Bruce Fraser?
Well, very much indeed. He wasn't. He was sort of very solid, absolutely. You know, you felt you could trust him, as you could with James Somerville. Was that he was a much more open character. He used to call me Bloody Favour. As I say, I was rather pompously. My official title was Fleet Aviation Officer. Was as a acting lieutenant commander at the age of 26, I felt this is a bit too much. But anyhow, Bloody Favour was, and Sir James got on very well, I'm pleased to say. Yes. And so did Bruce Fraser. We were co-Scots, of course, so we had a lot in common there. And then the Eastern Fleet expanded and began to form up to go and to be the unit for the British Pacific Fleet. And I was sent to become Staff Officer Air to the Vice Admiral, which meant a bit of seagoing, which is very nice. Again, with the most delightful staff.
What did you go to see in?
King George V.
Did you get anywhere near the action?
Oh, yes. Well, we set off, of course, to get to the Pacific, down the Sumatran coast. And the four carriers did those strikes on the Indonesian oil refineries. And we were attacked by Japanese aeroplanes who came out and just flew round and round until they were all shot down.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, about kamikaze attacks.
Yes, that is when we got out to the Pacific. And the British Task Force, Task Group, it was part of the overall American-British task fleet. And we were on one of the wings, and our job was to attack the airfields through which Japanese aircraft were being flown from their sort of Indonesian and sort of East Indies airfields to defend the mainland. And so they were kept strafed the whole time. And we were on, on the western wing of the combined task force, cruising in a big circular formation. That's with the carriers in the center in a sort of square formation, and one or two battleships in the middle there, providing extra air defense, and the destroyers and cruisers on the screen. And you'd get an air raid warning red, and the possibility of kamikaze strikes, and you all get very tensed up, wait for things to happen. And as I remember, I saw two little tubby aeroplanes coming towards us, and I told the Admiral to get flat on the deck, I thought we were going to be kamikazed, and they... Two Hellcats flew over and landed on one of the carriers, and my face was a bit red, and I said, "That's all right, sorry, sir, better safe than never." I should say that when there was an air raid warning red, the staff all disappeared into the conning tower under behind 11 inches of armour. But the Admiral didn't think this was right for him with so many personnel out at open action stations that he should go too. So he stayed out on the flag deck with his assistant, which was Jay Lang, sort of advise him of the air situation. And so I thought it was my special responsibility to look after him. He was a very tall man, of course I was a little man, but so I got down to the deck quicker. But a few hours later, I saw another pair of tubby aeroplanes approaching the KG-5. And I said, I think this is all right, sir. Two more Hellcats. And immediately, and little holes were drilled just above our heads on the funnel casings behind us. Then they went up a bit, gained some height, and then dived into the carriers.
Where was this?
This was in the Pacific, off the Sakishima Gunto Islands. Yes. It's the most terrible thing to see a chap deliberately fly his aeroplane into a flight deck. The captain of the Indomitable was a Japanese interpreter, and they discovered from the crash some notes, pilot's notes for a kamikaze pilot, of which I think of interest was, if your engine stops, switch off and fly home. or words to that effect.
So you found it nauseating to think that they were doing this rather than admiration for their bravery.
Well, you certainly had admiration for their bravery, but I suppose that it was obviously so hyped up. I mean, if you're from the birth a sort of told this, rather like a Muslim, doesn't he? He's going to heaven if he kills an infidel or something.
Was the KG-5 damaged at all much?
No.
But presumably it did a lot of shelling in the...
Well, we flew, banged off a lot of anti-aircraft guns, of course. But then we bombarded the Japanese coast. I can't remember quite what it was. And we ran in at night and shelled these airfields with, I think, there was a Black Widow American spotter plane. And we did hit the target, but an awful lot of shells didn't. I think that was just... I don't know whether it's anybody's fault or something, but the Americans were with us.